All right. At 3:19, calling the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order for Monday, February 20th, 2017, room 124 of the Capitol Building. And a reminder to please turn your cell phones off. And I will go through the roll. Members present are Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Stutes, Vice Chair Wool, Representative Knopp, Representative Birch, and Representative Josephson. We have a full committee to conduct business. We have one bill on the docket today. That bill is House Bill 79. It is the governor's omnibus workers' compensation bill. We do not plan on passing or moving this bill today. We do plan on trying to get through department presentations, and if we do have time, we'll open public testimony. We will, if we don't have time for public testimony, defer public testimony to a future meeting, and then we will continue our discussion then. But in the meantime, I think we are at the point where the department can come up, present the bill, and let us know where we're going with House Bill 79. So Commissioner Gregus and Ms. Marks, can you place your name and affiliation on the record and begin your testimony?
Yes, and thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Heidi Dragas. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
And I'm Marie Marks. I'm the Director of Workers' Compensation.
And just as a matter of protocol, when you're answering questions, make sure you re-identify yourself so our recording secretary can attribute the answer correctly.
Thank you. For the record, Heidi Dragas, Commissioner of the Department. Thank you for hearing HB 79 today. This bill will speed up resolution of disputes, improve delivery of benefits to injured employees, deter workers' compensation fraud, reduce administrative costs, and provide adequate funding for the administration of the workers' compensation system. The legislature has consistently endeavored to create a workers' compensation system that delivers benefits quickly, efficiently, fairly, and predictably to injured workers at a reasonable cost to employers as mandated by statute. The system has not been significantly reformed in more than 10 years. The improvements in this bill address rising costs, recent legal developments, and new approaches to improve the system's efficiency and fairness. This bill focuses on efficiencies. The department recognizes that benefit issues such as reemployment benefits and medical costs do need attention. The department is committed to addressing those issues in another legislative session. Here to take the committee through the bill is Marie Marks, who is the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation.
Good afternoon. Again, for the record, my name is Marie Marks. I'm the Director of Workers' Compensation. The division administers the Alaska Workers' Compensation Act. So I want to begin with the intent of the act set out in statute, which is also the division's mission. As the commissioner stated, it's to ensure the quick, efficient, fair, and predictable delivery of benefits to injured workers at a reasonable cost to employers. Balancing of these pillars guides the division's administration. The governor's bill, as the commissioner stated, addresses all of the statutory pillars, but especially focuses on fairness, quickness, and efficiency in the workers' compensation process. Because the governor's workers' compensation efficiencies bill is a large one, with changes for each topic made throughout the bill, I thought it would be more helpful to the committee if I instead conducted the sectional analysis by topic instead of in numerical order. First, HB 79 speeds up dispute resolution in various ways. HB 79 simplifies and quickens the hearing process by letting the board schedule a hearing shortly after a claim is filed, instead of waiting for an employee to request a hearing. It also ends the practice of permitting non-attorneys who are not bound by the rules of ethical and professional conduct from representing parties before the Alaska Workers' Compensation Board. I'd like to clarify that a parent, guardian, or other court-appointed representative may still represent a party in board proceedings. Additionally, the board will continue to consider a company, employer, or medical provider to be self-represented when acting through an authorized employee a member partner or a corporate executive officer. This change does not affect a party's ability to be represented by an attorney, including an attorney's ability to employ the services of paralegals and delegating functions to them. That's governed by the Alaska Rules of Professional Conduct. We permit that. We will continue to permit that. However, other non-attorneys may not represent a party in matters before the board. HB 79 streamlines settlements agreements by eliminating a requirement that the board approve attorney's fees as part of a settlement agreement when fees are the only issue in the settlement that requires board approval. It streamlines the process of imposing civil penalties against uninsured employers by allowing the Division of Workers' Compensation to assess the penalty directly rather than petitioning the board to set the penalty.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes,
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wasn't sure if you wanted to, you know, field a few questions as we roll through this or not. I've actually been approached by, I think it was the chamber, I can't remember, it was the state chamber of commerce, had some concerns about, you know, workers' compensation and kind of the structure and whatnot. And so obviously, if you're dealing with workers, you're also dealing with employers. So I guess one of my questions would be, to what extent have these changes been reviewed, considered, you know, evaluated? I'm not sure what the business entity would be. You know, you got the Federation of Independent Businesses, the state chambers, and so forth. But my question would be, how much engagement was involved with employers and the people that are most that these workers are basically employed by? Through the chair.
You want me to take it? Through the chair, Representative Birch, I'll have Marie answer part of this. This is Heidi Dragas. Leading up to this bill, we had numerous listening sessions across the state. It was actually the previous director prior to Marie and actually prior to my tenure who had listening sessions to try to figure out how could we improve the system that we have. And so that was definitely part of that process. As far as devising the bill, besides that, I mean, we get input all the time about how to improve the workers' compensation system. It's a balance. There is a balance. You have to balance the injured workers' rights against the employer's rights for a reasonable fair cost. And that is, it's a tricky challenge. It's a challenge that I didn't fully appreciate until I was in this position. Mm-hmm. So we have had numerous conversations with insurance companies, businesses, complainants, attorneys about ways that we could improve the process. And that in addition to the expertise that we have within the department is what culminated in the proposed bill. We are actually continuing to have those conversations as we rolled out the bill and we'll work through the committee process.
Yep. By way of follow-up, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that. I think that's very, very helpful, and at least from my perspective, it would be nice if that input could be solicited or provided. And I know typically I guess you put it out there and you have public testimony and so forth, but I haven't actively solicited any engagement on this, but I just wanted to make sure that the businesses that are actually employing our workers, obviously we any injury is one too many, but I just want to make sure that everybody's got a seat at the table and that it's just not a one-sided program. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome. Continue.
Where are we at?
Yeah, we're just following up again for the record. Marie Marks, the Director of Workers' Compensation. I just wanted to add a quick follow-up thought to streamlining the process of opposing civil penalties. I just wanted to add that an employer who disputes a civil penalty assessment may still challenge the assessment before the board. The bill also improves the delivery of medical care by requiring an employer to pre-authorize or deny medical treatment upon a medical provider's written request, and provides a reasonable time frame, 60 days, for this to happen. And the reason that this was established is that there is litigation that has resulted about whether, and it's usually expensive surgery, about whether an employer needs to pre-authorize medical care. Under the Act as it stands now, I think that one interpretation is that a bill, the only extent of the duty is to pay a medical bill, but an actual bill, within 30 days. The Alaska Supreme Court recently came out with an opinion. It didn't decide this issue, but it did state in there that isn't the extent of an employer's duty. They didn't go into and expand on what that includes, but as you can imagine, a doctor doesn't necessarily want to move forward with an expensive surgery if they don't know if it's going to be paid. An injured worker doesn't want to move forward with an expensive surgery, not knowing who's going to pay for it. And so this is to really reduce confusion and litigation on this pre-authorization issue. The medical benefits, right now, medical benefits are paid every 14 days with a 7-day grace period. That would be clarified to say it's just paid every 21 days with no grace period. Medical bills, I put this in here to show that there is no change to the existing law that medical bills are paid still within 30 days. The division is tackling misclassification. Misclassification is a topic the division is committed to address on behalf of both workers and law-abiding businesses. We are doing a great disservice to both when we do not tackle misclassification head-on. When workers are fraudulently misclassified, workers die or severely injured, and uninsured losses can put a company out of business. HB 79 does not prevent true independent contractors from existing and flourishing. It's also important to clarify that HB 79 addresses independent contractor status only in regards to workers' compensation. It does not change the definition of independent contractor for other purposes, such as IRX, tax purposes, or anything else non-workers' compensation related. It's a narrow application. We must keep workers safe, and law-abiding employers should not have to pay the price for misclassification. To strengthen the Workers' Compensation Act's fraud provisions by employers and employees, HB 79 defines when an employer's misclassification amounts to fraud under the Alaska Workers' Compensation Act. It also imposes an affirmative duty on employees receiving benefits to report work and receipt of other types of wage loss replacement benefits. It expands personal liability for workers' compensation benefits and civil penalties for failure to insure to owners of more types of businesses. This section really is closing a loophole. When the Act was created, when it made corporations liable for benefits if the corporation didn't carry insurance, it didn't state LLCs. It didn't include limited liability companies in there. And so we're really closing a loophole that allows corporations to be liable but not limited liability companies for uninsured, essentially compensation when they were uninsured. It defines independent contractor status instead of relying on a convoluted multi-factor test of employee, and it grants the division the ability to claim a lien on behalf of the Benefits Guarantee Fund, and that's our injured worker fund. Right now, an injured worker can go and file a lien immediately regarding that claim, but the Benefit Guarantee Fund cannot, and it's to secure compensation benefits that the fund pays out, as well as assessment of a civil penalty. HB 79 expands the division's ability to assess a civil penalty to include employers who are underinsured because they have misclassified workers. Right now, the only thing division can do is to assess a penalty when an employer fails to carry insurance. There's no recourse, nothing we can do to get those employers who are underclassifying and underbidding other employers, other companies, to bring them into compliance. And this allows us to do that. The bill changes the calculation and maximum civil penalty for a failure to insure for workers' compensation liability. Right now, the maximum penalty is $1,000 for each uninsured employee workday, and this has led to two unintended consequences. The first, it's resulted in astronomically high penalties that do not withstand review on appeal, and it increases the litigation costs and employer defaults. And second, uninsured employers that do not maintain accurate records, they're actually frequently penalized less severely than an employer who keeps records as required by law, just because of the difficulty of establishing the number of uninsured employee workdays without those records. So the bill corrects those issues.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Knopp.
Thank you. So explain to me a little bit about underinsured employees, if you would, please.
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, correct. There's a various ways that an employer can underinsure for fraudulent purposes, and we're talking about fraudulent misclassification, for the purpose of avoiding payment of work comp premium in full or in part. So you can pay people under the table, or you can tell your insurance company that the people working for you are clerical when they're actually roofers, and therefore you can pay a premium that's a lot less. You can say you have no employees and that you lease these employees from a different company that you happen to own in full as well, that has no injury history and isn't a high-risk industry, maybe like construction. So there's various ways that you can underinsure. And this bill, through our definition of misclassification, and that's one thing that we're addressing here, will ensure a level playing field to make sure that workers are properly classified.
Okay, thank you.
And Representative Josephson has a question.
Thank you. Through the chair, it's Ms. Marks, right?
Correct.
Okay. On the maximum civil penalty of three times the premium, I see that you've toughened up the ability to suspend and the interest part. But what is the when you say three times premium, do you mean monthly premium, or how is this a deterrent from fraudulently claiming that these are independent contractors?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, so it would be three times the premium that would have been paid had that employer maintained insurance as required by law. And so the division would conduct an investigation, as it does now, and it would have to have substantial evidence, as it does now, to find that those workers were improperly and fraudulently misclassified. And then it would come up with a penalty amount, as if all those employees were properly classified.
Follow up. So through the chair, it's the times the number of months of failure to pay for a premium.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that's correct. The premium would be based on the length of time that the employer failed to carry insurance.
Okay, thanks.
HB 79, following up on that with penalty calculation, that the calculation would be simpler because it requires, as we discussed, the employer's overall payroll data calculated as if the employer had properly classified its employees, as well as the Division of Insurance assigned risk rates for the nature of the employer's business. So this, the new penalty, it will still result in a reasonable deterrent, but it takes into account the employer's size of their business, the nature of their business, is it high risk, is it low risk, and the financial gain that the employer realized by operating in full or in part without workers' compensation insurance. HB 79 also clarifies that civil penalties may not be suspended. The Alaska Workers' Compensation Board currently often suspends penalties in full or in part to address, I think, what the astronomically high penalties that have been resulting. However, it's resulted in penalties without sideboards. The new calculation puts sideboards on these assessments. It ties that penalty to the employer's size, type of business, and financial gain that the employer realized by not having workers' compensation insurance. The bill does allow an employer to enter into a payment plan to pay the civil penalty in installments. This ensures an employer is not put out of business by a civil penalty assessment, though HB 70 requires interest to be paid on these payment plans at the state rate for judgments. The bill reduces administrative costs by allowing employers to pay benefits electronically. This delivers benefits faster at a cost savings to workers. It allows the division to prescribe the filing format. I think our reports of injury and statute say that we have to put them in a stamped envelope now. And we just want the ability to prescribe the format so as technology changes, we can keep up with that technology, including requiring electronic filing of records. The bill would eliminate a requirement that corporate executive officers seek the division's approval before opting out of workers' compensation coverage for themselves. Right now, they have to file a lengthy application, and we spend a lot of time reviewing that. Insurance companies call us to verify who has an executive officer waiver on file. That takes an enormous amount of time to respond to those inquiries. Those members, corporate executive officers and members of limited liability companies with at least a 10% ownership interest, they're not employees. Therefore, they don't need workers' compensation coverage. And that's something that's easy verifiable by going to the Division of Corporations or looking at the company's bylaws and business incorporation documents. HB 79 also reduces administration costs by adding some medical publications to the list that the Department of Labor and Workforce Development can incorporate in using its fee schedule, including future amended versions. This allows us to incorporate the future amended versions without going through a lengthy process to do that. It provides a penalty for insurers and employers that fail to timely submit proof of insurance coverage. Right now, there's no deadline for renewals, for reporting renewals to us, no penalty to do it on time. I think that these renewals sit on someone's desk, and I think the states that have a penalty probably get reported first, and they don't make them to Alaska until sometimes our division has investigated a failure to insure only to find out that there was proof of insurance, it just hadn't yet been filed with the division. And so this will reduce the time we spent investigating failure to insure cases that actually have coverage, and they just haven't yet been reported to us. HB 79 also phases out the second injury fund. This will save the department administrative costs and reduce costs for employers that are required to contribute to the fund. As I think we've mentioned before, the fund's purpose is to encourage employers to hire or retain individuals with disabilities, but the fund is no longer necessary with the passage of the American with Disabilities Act and other laws that bar employment discrimination. Under the bill, the fund would not accept new claims. It would be phased out as current claims are paid. So employers' required contributions to the fund would gradually drop to zero as the claims are paid. And so far, about half the states, 19 of them, have phased out these types of funds. And finally, the HB 79 ensures adequate funding for the administration of the Workers' Compensation Safety Administrative Account. We call this WISCA. I'm going to refer it to WISCA just because that's a mouthful to say. WISCA balance is rapidly declining. In 2005, the Alaska legislature established programs such as the Workers' Compensation Fraud Unit and the Medical Services Review Committee. These programs are funded by WISCA, but there was no increase in the WISCA fee rate to account for the increased cost to operate these programs. The bill would allow the department to receive a greater percentage of the annual service fees that insurers pay. It would not collect more money from insurers. It would just allow a greater percentage to be allocated to the division, which would otherwise go to the general fund. And that's all I have. I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Birch.
Just in a gross numbers, what does the 2.5 plus 0.5%, that three, call it 3%, what does that generate in total funding to the nearest $1 million? I was just curious as to, just in round numbers, looks like it's about the same as what you had before. It looks like a little different distribution here.
So through the chair, Representative Birch, I think I understand your question. The difference, the 0.67% change, would equate to $1.8 million annually.
Great. Thank you.
And that's based on fiscal year 2016 collected tax revenue.
Thank you.
Representative Justin.
Through the chair, Ms. Marks, is there any belief that employers' workers' compensation rates will drop because the pool will grow? That is, the number of people paying for workers' comp will be expanded in some way? I mean, I don't know if there's some correlation to uncovered people, and I don't know.
through the chair, Representative Josephson. I don't have hard numbers, but you're correct in that the more people that purchase workers' compensation insurance and cover their employees, the greater the risk is spread out. And workers' compensation, it's an allocation of risk, and it spreads it out through the numerous employers. And so there will be more employers sharing that cost and that burden.
Thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Marks or Commissioner Dragas? Representative Knopp?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you speak to the two fiscal notes just a little bit? So is that what we're looking at, fiscal note number three there? So is that that's the benefit we're looking to gain? I see it's looking like it's increasing $400,000 every year up to $2 million in 23. Is am I reading that correctly?
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, no, the savings would be the cost of the savings on administrative expenses if we go to electronic filing. The fiscal note, and I believe you're looking at the second injury fund fiscal note, it is a wash. It's essentially a wash. The Workers' Compensation Division does not pay the costs for the second injury fund. We collect them from employers and insurance companies, and we reimburse employers and insurance companies. And so the fiscal note just shows that the money is categorized differently over the years. So as we take in less money from employers, we'll be paying out more in liabilities. And I probably would turn to our division's budget expert to kind of talk about how those monies are allocated. But for the division, there is no fiscal impact on, other than hopefully down the road we will save administrative expenses. And most second injury fund claims are permanent total disability, which means we generally pay it for the life of the claimant. And so if we start phasing it out now, down the road we hope to save those administration expenses.
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, we do have our administrative services director, Paloma Harbor, is monitoring the committee. I'm not sure if she's online right now, but she can speak to these fiscal notes fairly soundly. So we'll see if we have more questions, we'll see if she can call in and we can make sure that we have hard and fast answers to these.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Yeah, I'm good, and just a brief overview. I saw the two fiscal notes, and I'll formulate some questions, and we have a number we can call and call you when we get some more. So nothing pressing right now. Thanks all for that.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Marks. Thank you, Commissioner Dragas. And for members of the committee, we do have Assistant Attorney General Kimber Rogers online for questions, and Rhonda Gerhards, who's the Chief Investigator for the Division of Workers' Comp, online. So does anyone have any questions for either of those two individuals? If not, I think we will go ahead and move on to public testimony. We'll open public testimony. Public testimony is open, and we do have two individuals that have signed up to testify. We've got Aves Thompson from the Alaska Trucking Association. Aves, can you place your name and affiliation on the record and begin your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Aves Thompson, Executive Director of the Alaska Trucking Association. The Alaska Trucking Association is a statewide organization representing the interests of our nearly 200 member companies from Barrow to Ketchikan. Freight movement represents a large chunk of our economy and impacts all of us each and every day. The simple truth is that if you got it, the truck brought it. HB 79 proposes changes in AS 2330.230A11 to add language to define the, quote, tests to determine when a person is an independent contractor for purposes of workers' compensation coverage. The Alaska Trucking Association has some concerns about these tests. The independent contractor or owner-operator business model has played an important role in the trucking industry for decades. Owner-operators serve a valued function within the trucking industry. They are small business owners who rely on their prudent decision-making and hard work to earn a living and build a business. They offer professionally staffed hauling and delivery capability to motor carriers. Their revenues and profits are directly tied to their level of effort and business judgments, that is, choosing the right truck, such as the make, model, and condition for their operations, deciding how best to finance that truck, select repair and maintenance vendors, and deciding whether to hire drivers or substitute drivers. But those initial decisions are only the tip of the iceberg. Ongoing business decisions must be made regarding fueling times, vendors, software use, including routing programs, insurance coverages, and a wide variety of other needed products and services. One of the most critical decisions that an owner-operator make is their selection of a motor carrier partner. They must select a carrier whose operations and procedures fit the contractor's business plan. Then, as the business grows, the owner-operator must decide the utility of acquiring additional trucks and hiring more drivers and decide whether to partner with multiple carriers. Motor carriers can rely on the owner-operator's independent motivation and business skills without having to apply the constant and detailed control necessary with carrier employee drivers. The basic bargain the owner-operator strikes with each of its motor carrier customers turns on the potential for mutual profit. If the owner-operator works hard and makes smart decisions, he or she profits. The motor carrier profits by professional, timely, and efficient delivery of freight by this self-motivated independent contractor. The motor carrier can conserve its management resources for other key tasks such as business generation, customer service, and financial management. Owner-operators are an effective method for the industry to quickly respond to changing customer or market demands by allowing expansion and contraction of the workforce. It is also important to note that equipment and driver leasing in the trucking business is heavily regulated by both Federal Statute 49 U.S.C. 14102, Leased Motor Vehicles, and U.S. DOT Regulation 49 CFR Part 376, Lease and Interchange of Vehicles. The proposed changes to the work comp statute essentially preclude the use of owner-operators in the trucking business in a number of different ways. The rules or tests proposed in House Bill 79 dealing with economic reality in paragraph 11A on page 16 or 17 rules out an owner-operator who works primarily for one motor carrier, although the owner-operator may work occasionally for other motor carriers. The second instance is in 11E, which leaves open interpretation of, quote, the direction of motor carrier to the contractor, or, as we call them, owner-operators, and does not clearly specify that many times direction is given to the owner-operator that results from customer demands or the requirement of some level of governmental law or regulation. The third instance is found in 11F that prohibits a motor carrier from hiring an owner-operator to haul a load of freight. Our first recommendation is to provide an exemption in AS 2330-230A that will exempt truck drivers from the provisions of this act in the same way that taxi drivers and network transportation drivers are exempted in current law and in Senate Bill 14. This will clearly establish the truck driver owner-operator business model in Alaska law. Our second recommendation is the adoption of a distinct truck driver independent slash owner independent contractor slash owner operator definition and set of tests. We have provided specific language to the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Workforce Development to accomplish our recommendation. Thirdly, we have provided proposed changes to the language contained in House Bill 79 that will help to address our issues, but not as effectively as our first recommendation. We are happy to work with the proposers of the changes to assist in clarifying the issues. Thank you for your time, and I will try to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Do we have any questions from members of the committee?
Yes.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair, for Mr. Thompson, the subsections that were problematic were specifically 11E and F, and you had, I think, one other before 11E. Can you repeat what that was?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, is 11A, 11E, and 11F.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Thompson? Thank you for testimony, Mr. Thompson.
And thank next, you, Mr. Chairman.
We have the Homer LIO, Shelley Erickson. Can you state your name and affiliation on the record and begin your testimony?
Thank you. I'm Shelley Erickson, a small business owner. We have been the recipient of a claim against our workman's comp policy. It has been frustrating that the state of Alaska laws in this area appear to be in favor of the employee no matter what the situation, and I believe that these issues need to be addressed also when you're dealing with the fraud. There needs to be laws in place to protect the small businesses from the abuse of employees that are not following the policies for safety set in place or using the safety gear they are instructed to. A law appears to assume that the business is irresponsible. New hires need to reveal or release workmen's comp records because the problem is that it's really hard, especially when you have a specialized business and you come to find out after you spend hundreds of dollars to get this person in place that you actually have someone that should not have been there in the first place. The third place that I have noticed that the law is in favor of the employee is also with a boat owner. They are assumed to be negligent, and in dealing with the insurance, they have to cave to that deckhand, even though the deckhand's in the wrong. The biggest cost of our workers' comp insurance rate with our for the small business is fraud. There's a huge amount of fraud going on. There, I believe that there needs to be fair consequences to anyone on either side, either the employer or the employee. Right now, it appears to be a one-sided system where the businesses are the ones that are in the wrong and not the employee. Right now, we are living in a day and age when more and more people are desperate in their private lives, and the more desperate they are, the more they are looking at ways to get around the law and to find money. And this includes fraudulent workman's comp cases. If the law cannot be written so these issues can be fixed within the insurance industry, then the state needs to provide a place for the abuse that is happening within the law to be addressed and make it fair for both sides. I appreciate your time and thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Erickson. Any questions? Representative Birch.
I just thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to thank you for your testimony, and it mirrors some of the frustration and the concerns that I have heard. Have you managed to advance them through any, either in one form or another, through any elected officials or locally at any point? And I'm just wondering if there's a summary of some of these modifications and how they've been addressed or if they've been addressed.
No, I've not been able to get very far, and I've been talking with my insurance agent, and they seem, the insurance agency, every time we come up against this in talking, that they're coming up against a wall, too, that the whole issue of employee fraud, nobody's really willing to deal with it. At least that's what I'm coming up with. I have sent a copy of my letter with the SB 29 and 69, and then today also with kind of a little bit more detail. But everywhere that I've tried to go over the years to talk about this, and basically, I'm just running into a brick wall because it seems like nobody wants to think that maybe the employee could actually be fraudulent.
Yeah, follow up. I would just like to thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule. Everybody's, especially a small business owner, you tend to have a lot of irons in the fire, a lot of work to do, and I appreciate you taking the time to come down here and testify, and we'll look forward to seeing how we can best address this through this legislative process. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Erickson? Thank you, Ms. Erickson. We have one other person identified online, Scott Jordan, Risk Management Director, available for questions in case anyone has any questions. So
Who's he work for?
The State of Alaska Division of Risk Management. Okay, so Mr. Jordan, we do have a question for you. You can place your name and affiliation on the record, and we'll get to the question.
For the record, I'm Scott Jordan, Director, Division of Risk Management for Department of Administration.
Thank you, and Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Jordan, for joining us this afternoon. I've heard over the years anecdotally of issues and concerns as it relates to, particularly small businesses and fraud. I'm personally aware of a few instances that way, but how do we go about making sure that we have a mechanism and basically legislation that is effectively deals with that? My sense is that as per the testimony of the gentleman from the Alaska Truckers Association, there's a lot of independent businesses in the state, a lot of small businesses, and by and large, they're out working and not able to join us at middle of the afternoon during the week, how do you go about kind of drawing in that kind of commentary, making sure that we're a responsive government and a responsive community to those business concerns that are out there?
Through the chair, I'm not sure I'm the person to answer that question. We serve as kind of a self-insurer for workers' comp for State of Alaska employees, so I think your question is more towards how do we deal with fraud and how do we attack that? Is that, am I understanding you correctly?
I guess I'm just trying to get an understanding. We put a mechanism or a framework in place for dealing with workers' comp. Very, very reasonable and a very positive objective. I guess what I'm trying to understand is, and if I understand what you're saying, is that you're dealing with primarily State of Alaska employees, State of Alaska type related issues, and I'm kind of looking at this from a larger context as far as the business. When we have some testimony here from a small business person and from a trade association that represents hundreds of small business persons in the area of owner operator trucking operators. So I guess maybe to that extent you may not be the right person, and we'll get through that. But from the state standpoint, what's the magnitude of our risk, and how many employees are involved, and how many what sort of benefit cost is there associated with a workers' comp on the state side, and how many employees are represented?
Through the chair, there's about 17,000 full-time employees with the State of Alaska. Now that excludes university, railroad, some of the smaller corporations. We pay out about anywhere from $26 million to $30 million a year in benefits, and about 65% of that is medical. So the rest would be indemnification benefits, time loss benefits.
And if I might, Mr. Chairman, how many employees does that represent? 26 to 30 million a year out of your 17,000 employee base? Is that 1,000 or 500 or 50?
It's through the chair. It's about 1,200 a year. Yeah, we run for about the last 15 years. We've ran about 1,200 employees that have turned in workers' comp claims.
Wow.
Per year.
So 10% would be 1,700. So we're probably talking. Is that how does that compare, if you will, in the industry?
Through the chair, I couldn't answer that.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Jordan? Thank you, Mr. Jordan. I do have a question, follow up question for Ms. Marks.
For the record, my name is Ray Marks. I'm the Director of Workers' Compensation.
Thank you, Ms. Marks, for coming back up to the table. And we had some discussion about the independent contractor language identified on page 17, starting at line 9. And if you could help me understand where that language was derived from, it looks like some of that might actually be federal. But was there a working group? Was there something that this came from? How was that language developed for this section?
Chair Kito, the
language started, it's been an ongoing process, and we have a misclassification work group, and Rhonda Gerhardt's on the line, so I may turn to her if I would like some input from her. But many states, to combat the issue of fraud, have started a statewide misclassification work group that kind of brings in all types of entities, agencies, state agencies, to work together to combat misclassification. And I'd say the last 10 years, this has been a hot issue nationwide since 2007, to look at this issue. So since 2007, I would say most states have really tried to get away from these convoluted multi-factor balancing tests and get to a little bit clearer definition of what constitutes an independent contractor. We looked at all 50 states, and every 50 state has a little bit different test. So when you, Chair Kito, when you said this looks like the federal test, the federal government, IRS, has a 20-factor balancing test. This isn't that test. The IRS has a different goal, and that's to collect tax payments. The work comp goal and purpose is a little bit narrower, to prevent workplace injuries and protect employers from uninsured losses. Of the states that have dealt with the test, we kind of looked at all states and looked at what language they had, and through our with our drafters and department, kind of came up with a list of things that help to identify what is a separate business. So these are kind of recurring hallmarks that we saw that states had come up with, kind of hallmarks that identify what is truly an independent, distinct, separate business. And so we crafted this language.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Marks. And as kind of a follow-up to that, it seems as though, I guess the question is, applying this language to determine whether an individual is an independent contractor would determine whether or not that individual would be responsible for getting their own workers' compensation policy, or whether the employer would be required to provide that workers' compensation policy. Is that correct?
Chair Kito, that is correct. That a definition sets forth what is an independent contractor. Independent contractors are not employees. The Workers' Compensation Act applies to employees. It offers that coverage for employees. What are you if you're not an independent contractor or you're an employee? Well, you could be a volunteer. You could be a trespasser. You could be there, you know, unlawfully. But for most intents and purposes, you're either an independent contractor or you're an employee. So you're correct. If you're an independent contractor, you wouldn't have to carry workers' compensation coverage for yourself, though we do encourage people, because the cost of uninsured losses can financially devastate an employer.
Thank you. Representative Birch has a question, then Representative Knott.
Yeah, was the we had testimony from Alaska Truckers Association. Were they involved in any of your outreach? Or I mean, as a, they're clearly a large independent contractor organization.
Through the chair, Representative Birch, this has been a many years process where we have heard comments that were provided at, as the commissioner mentioned, listening sessions, at our board member board meetings. We take public comment. People call me on the telephone. I encourage them to do that and say, you know, please call me. Let me know of issues. So we took comment. And a similar version of this bill made its way through the House last year, this a similar independent contractor language where we had discussions, got feedback. And so we have met with different groups, such as the group you're talking about, Representative Birch, and are refining this definition. We do not want to prevent true independent contractors from operating. We want them to operate. We just want to make sure that those employers who are following the law operate on the same level playing field as those that do not.
Just by way of follow-up, I would just encourage you to, I mean, all of us as politicians know the difference between outreach and being reached out to, you know, whether it's broadcast or receive, and we do a lot of receiving here, but on the broadcast, I would certainly encourage you to reach out to those organizations and businesses that may have a lot of independent contractors, because I think it's, you know, it's going to be a very, it's going to have a dramatic impact on them, and it would be constructive if were that to happen.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I have a follow-up on the the prior testimony from Mr. Jordan that 1,200 out of 17,000 state employees basically have filed largely medical claims amounting to $26 to $30 million a year. I just did the quick math on my phone here, and that's about a 7%. That's 7%. That seems like a very significant number. Do you know how that compares to what you're seeing across the the broad employee base in the state of Alaska and how many workers' comp claims? And maybe it's in line. I just don't know. It seems like a very large percent for somebody that's somewhat familiar with the oil patch, where you basically go a million hours without a lost time injury. 7% for our state employee base seems like, hopefully they're not all paper cuts, but I'm assuming if it's medical attention, that's pretty serious business.
Through the chair, Representative Birch, I don't know if I'm have an expert to be able to speak on that, but all the employers or employees in Alaska, I mean, I think there's a substantial number of them. So many, 300,000, 400,000, again, I'm not the expert, so I probably shouldn't estimate how many workers there are or employers there are out there, but of those hundreds of thousands, the number of workplace injuries that are reported are about 20,000. And of those 20,000, the ones that actually file claims with the Workers' Compensation Board, meaning for some reason benefits aren't flowing smoothly, so in most cases they do, of the 20,000, it's about 1,200 that end up being disputed. And so I think it's a small portion of that. Through the chair, Representative Birch, it looks like I may not have answered your question.
Well, it struck me that we were just talking about 1,200. We're talking 1,200 state employees that had claims out of 17,000, and you're saying there's also 1,200 claims out of the 300,000 workforce?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, and I think this is an issue that because of the terms that are being used, it causes confusion. So it's that insurance companies consider their injuries claims. They term that claims. That's different when I'm speaking of the 1,200 claims. That means an actual application for benefits because something isn't being paid. And I would have to defer to Mr. Jordan, but I believe what he's talking about is an injury where they pay benefits versus an injury where benefits are disputed and the claimant needs to file something with the board to begin the process to figure out whether benefits are owed. So claim can mean two different things.
Okay,
here.
Well, by follow-up, I would like to have an apples-to-apples comparison to see how the state of Alaska is measuring up with workers' comp and employee injuries and whether we, in fact, have a safe place to a safe environment for work. And then if they're medical, it's not gone unnoticed by me that we have a proliferation of chiropractors in Anchorage. I mean, there's one in every street corner. And so I'm not sure, I don't know if these things are related, but I would like to understand if we're providing a safe workplace for our employees, and if it's like I say, 7% seems like an incredibly large number to me for injuries of that go all the way through the path to a workers' compensation claim, and then if we could see how the state of Alaska compares to the industry industry as a whole statewide, that would be instructive to me as to whether how good a job are we doing in protecting our employees.
And through the chair, Representative Birch, that's that we don't keep those statistics. I would defer to the Division of Risk Management for information on their injury claims, and I believe it's Department of Labor Research and Analysis that keeps track of that type of comparison data. That is data that the Workers' Compensation Division, we administer reports of injury, we administer claims, but it sounds like, Representative Birch, you're looking for just how injury data of different industries and how it compares to others, and I believe that's Department of Labor. The Division of Research and Analysis does that in conjunction with the U.S. Department of Labor Statistics Bureau. But I'd be happy if make sure I really understand that. I want to make sure I get a clear idea of what you're asking for, and we can reach out to them to obtain that information, Representative Birch.
Oh, okay. Representative Birch, actually, yeah. We've got two other people that want to ask questions, and we've got two more minutes left in our meeting. So
okay,
like
I just would like to know if we have
Representative Birch, yeah. If you could maybe do that after the meeting, and we can get to a couple more questions here in
sure.
the meeting.
Sure, have at it.
Representative Knott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So thank you for that. So I just want to touch on a couple things. Particularly, this legislation is affecting the private sector. That's who we're trying to get some of the abuse cleaning up. Would you fair to say not so much about state employees or comp claims. We're talking about fixing some of the flaws in the system, primarily in the private sector. That's what this legislation does. Fair to say?
Through the chair, Representative Knopf, that is correct.
Okay, thank you. So,
follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Thompson testified, but before I go there, let me touch on this question real quick. Would you briefly, when you mentioned the 20,000 claims and the 20,000 claims, you should maybe mention in statute what is the minimum requirement for every time an employer has an employee who injured himself, even to the smallest degree, it's required to be reported. You might just touch on that briefly so everybody knows if you're an employee working for an employer, very small degree of injury you must report.
Through the chair, Representative Knopf, the statute requires all injuries to be reported. And I just quickly touch on why. There was an injured worker that got cut on his thumb and put a Band-Aid on it, as these sometimes these injured workers are wont to do, some Neosporin, and went on their way. Down the road, it got infected, and it ended up having significant medical care. And that is why all injuries, whether they require medical care or not, need to be reported. And that, I think, does have to do with the high number of reports of injury.
Follow up, Mr. Chair, briefly.
Follow up.
Thank you. I think she was talking about me on that thumb deal there. So. two more things quickly. Mr. Thompson talked about the trucking industry, and so a lot of this has effects on labor in that sense. So Title 36, prevailing wage stuff. So what happens a lot in the trucking industry, if a truck is getting $130 an hour and you go to put on a prevailing wage rate job, two things happen. It's the driver. If it's a lease truck or an owner-operator, he no longer has to pay himself that prevailing wage rate, nor does he have to provide himself a workman's comp rate or insure himself as an owner-operator or a guy that's leasing the truck. So I think that's a lot of Mr. Thompson's concerns. If I put my trucks on a prevailing wage rate job, I'd have to actually get about $170 an hour to pay that rate. So there's two benefits of doing that. So I think there's some unforeseen consequences if we define this this employer-employee relationship for workman's comp purposes. I'm just making a point that there are some other unforeseen consequences in the labor market with that. So, but what I want to ask you about is in the old days when I was working for industry, when we started our layoffs, we started hiring them back. It's what we called.
Representative Knopf, do you have a question?
This is a question. It's a PTE, professional term employees. So is that practice still in the marketplace today? Instead of independent contractors, are we going to go back to industry? Is there still a lot of that that will now be subject to? I'm not familiar with it. Okay.
Through the chair, Representative Knopf, I'm not familiar with PTEs in the terminology that you've put forth, but I do want to address the Mr. Thompson's concerns in that we are hearing from industry on this, and this is a very difficult thing to tackle worker misclassification. It's important, it's necessary, but we want to make sure we are casting the net as wide as is necessary. So we're working with the Alaska Truckers Association. We've had conversations with Mr. Thompson. He sent us some draft legislation that we are looking at. We've met with the NFIB, with the Home Builders Association, a few groups that have some concerns within the definition that we're taking a look at. So we know we have some refinement to do. And we appreciate hearing that, and we are looking at that actively.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Yes, just a quick comment that I know this is just one sliver of the problem, that there are other ways in which the failure whether it's misclassification, whether it's minimum wage or unemployment or any variety of other things, there are others that bear that expense. But I think relative to Representative Knopf's original comment, there was a legislator here who remains here who cut her hand and I assume needed stitches and had to have a report of harm. So I don't know if we get data back from risk management, I would like it real clear what's being defined, just as Ms. Marks indicated. because I don't think that legislator had a loss of time. I don't know that we had to pay for any loss of time. I think the other factor that I would just note that may play into this is, because I don't think state workers are clumsier or more prone to accident, but they may take some comfort in being organized and knowing that a report of injury isn't going to cause them any tension at the workplace. I don't know if you want to comment on that. But.
I don't quite know, to be honest, how to address that. Other than to say, this bill is meant to make the process more efficient for both injured workers and employers. It aims at fixing long-standing problems and gaps that really need to be resolved that will benefit injured workers and employers.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the one thing I would add is I do think there's probably less of a fear of retaliation. Retaliation is unlawful under the Workers' Compensation Act, but all of us know that it does happen. Mm-hmm. So that may be part of it, that when you are organized, you have a less fear that you're going to lose your job because you have other protections within your collective bargaining agreement. That may very well be part of it, but we don't have statistics to show that.
Thank you. We're going to go ahead and leave public testimony open. We are at 4:20, 5 minutes past our stop time. Reminder that we do have subcommittee meeting this evening at 4:30, so please don't go far and return. And with that, we are adjourned for Monday. Thank you.